You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 23rd of March 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, Belgium mourns victims of yesterday's bomb attacks in Brussels, which left at least 30 dead and hundreds wounded. We'll discuss the aftermath of those attacks with my guests Xenia Wickett and Kathleen Burke. We'll also hear from Monocle's Daniel Jacopelli, who's in the Belgian capital. And later in the programme, we'll look at the results of US President Barack Obama's visit to Cuba and ask if everyone actually welcomes the thawing of relations between the former Cold War foes. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome one and all to Midori House. My guests today are Xenia Wickett and Kathleen Burke. Xenia Wickett is the head of the US and Americas program at Chatham House, and Kathleen Burke is a professor of modern and contemporary history at University College London. We'll also be joined later in the program by Monocle's Daniel Jacopelli, who's in Brussels. At least 30 people are now known to have died in explosions at the Brussels main airport and underground station yesterday, while at least 200 were injured. Two of the suicide bombers have been named as brothers Khalid and Brahim El Bakrouri, both known to Belgian police, it turns out, for years as street criminals. Another man, caught on CCTV, is still on the run, despite earlier reports today that he had been caught. And Xenia Wickett, it's been quite a fast-moving day of different events, revelations about who knew what, where and when, and frankly, no security services coming out of this looking particularly good.
Yes, I was in Brussels actually over the weekend at a conference, we did talk about the security threat at that time, and of course, the Brussels Belgian government and the French government were congratulating themselves on capturing alive one of the individuals involved in the Paris attacks back at the end of last year. And of course, nobody anticipated 2 days later this. But I think it sends a very clear message that more is two things, really. One, on the part of the public, the reality is I think that we are going to have to get used to this, as of course we did in the UK back in the 70s with the IRA. We are going to have to get used to the fact that however good our security, this will occasionally happen. On the other hand, there is more that we can do in terms of sharing intelligence. There's still an amazing amount of problems in sharing intelligence between European states and getting better at protecting against this kind of event, not in terms of protecting every single soft site. We're never going to be able to do that, but recognizing the threat and sharing the intelligence.
Kathleen Burke, on that issue of intelligence services working together, security services working together, you know, as we've discussed a lot over the last 24 hours, this isn't just an intra-Europe issue here. There's an intra-Belgian issue here, that there are all sorts of police forces and security services in Belgium that really aren't communicating well with each other.
There's six separate police forces in Brussels and Belgium, in fact. And there are three separate languages, as we know, you know, Flemish and French and German. There are demarcation lines. That's a country without much of a government. It has been referred to as the wealthiest failed state in the world. It's hard. Obviously, yes, I agree with you, and I agree with Xenia. Intelligence cooperation is absolutely vital, but with whom do you cooperate? And if you cooperate with one part of the Belgian security services, will they tell the other part of the Belgian security services? I mean, the U.S. has the same problem between National Security Administration and the CIA and the FBI and so forth, but somehow you don't have quite the same difficulty. That is to say, when there are institutions doing the same thing, competing for resources, the thing they do is don't cooperate. This, with any luck, will make it clear to the Belgian security services that they have to, or their families are going to die.
I was living in the US after 9/11. Shortly after 9/11, I started doing Homeland Security in Washington, D.C. for various at various places at the State Department and the Vice President's office. And one of the real challenges then was facilitating what we used to call horizontal and vertical intelligence sharing. So within an institution up and down, but also between institutions. And I vividly remember being in meetings with the CIA and the FBI because they use intelligence differently. They do not want to share that intelligence and trying to force that agenda. This is exactly, and the US dealt with this now 15 years ago and is still struggling with it.
Why is it on that issue? Why do different agencies have these problems? Is it simply a case of sort of protecting one's turf and wanting to be the organisation that has the information? Or are there issues of trust here as well?
So there's all sorts of issues. Yes, protecting one's turf, but I actually don't think that's the principal issue. If you look at the US, the FBI uses intelligence to prosecute. The CIA uses intelligence to stop things happening. Very different things. If you actually use intelligence to stop things happening, you often can't use that to prosecute. So you have a problem there. So they have different mechanisms by which they achieve their objective, and therefore they have troubles in that respect. The other principal reason is sources and methods. Often you don't share intelligence, particularly not just within states, but certainly between states, because you are worried that if too many people figure out what the intelligence is and where it came from, your sources will be compromised. And so there is a lack of trust because you just don't want those sources to be compromised. It's not as sullied, if you will, as just saying it's my turf, not your turf. There is actually good reason for it. On the other hand, as the events over the last couple of days, and in fact, over the last few months have shown, it is time we got beyond it.
There's the other issue as well, Kathy, that we've just seen coming up in the last couple of hours, where the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has said, actually, we caught one of these guys not so long ago, and we deported him back to the Netherlands. And we told you guys in Europe that this had happened. You know, you've chosen to ignore it. That's your fault. There's the other problem there. It's very easy to look at that and go, well, Europe should have noticed this. But can European capitals always be confident that what they're getting from a country like Turkey is actually useful intelligence?
All 28 of them. Obviously, they have to do the best they can. They have to. Obviously, the source of it is important. The Turkish secret services, I may be wrong here, Xenia will correct me if I am, but I think they have a certain closeness to the American services for fairly obvious reasons. And therefore, if they told the British, the Americans would have known it as well because of the close intelligence sharing there. Now, it depends on who they told. Did they tell Angela Merkel? Did they tell the French? If they send it back to the Dutch, that they have less of a well-organized security service than many of the others. Not as bad as Belgians, but not really good.
And then the other problem, Xenia, is that it's all very well being told someone is a problem, but you talk to people in security services across Europe and they'll say, well, we've got a long list of people who are a problem. Yeah. We just don't know at what scale of a problem they are yet, and we don't have the staff power to deal with every single one.
Absolutely. And then you've got the problems that many of these names can be spelt in different ways, and so how do you cross-check that? You know, you've got the problem that what is considered by one security services to be a threat isn't necessarily considered by another service to be a threat, or certainly not so much of a threat.
This person is perhaps a member of Muslim Brotherhood, and so in some countries that's
exactly
an issue,
in other countries
not.
It isn't. So many of the Western services consider others to have political reasons for putting people on list, and vice versa. This is certainly not easy. There are good reasons why the intelligence sharing has been insufficient. On the other hand, time and time again, we learn that unless we know that these people are crossing borders. We know that the most likely place we'll catch them is as they cross borders, because that's where they are having to pass through government-run institutions, as it were. And so that is where we can catch them. And if we're not sharing information, we are tying our hands behind our backs. So we need to find a way to get around this.
Do you suppose that Schengen will go the way of the dodo then?
Well, I think that there is, I will say what a lot of people, other people have been saying today, which is Schengen and this threat are totally different things and should not be brought together. We don't know enough about the people who've the suicide bombers. We don't know enough about the people who've been involved in this. We don't know whether they were legitimately in the country, whether they were illegitimately in the country. We don't know whether they were Belgian or whether they were French. It is way too early to say that Schengen has facilitated this. The Schengen agreement has facilitated this. So putting together the discussions about Schengen and this kind of terrorist attack, it is far too early to start doing that.
I just want to bring in Daniel Giacopelli, who's in Brussels for us at the moment. And Danny, you know, we've been talking a lot here and across the programmes over the last 24 hours about the problems with the Belgian security services and how the Belgian state has perhaps fallen down on its job recently. When you've been talking to people over the last day or so, are people in Belgium accepting that this is a problem, or are they actually at the moment more sort of coming together and looking to their leaders to help build a sense of unity?
I think it's been a little bit of both, actually. I mean, some people we've seen have said, you know, this is the Belgian government's fault, essentially, because of the lack of intelligence cooperation. Other people, possibly younger people who don't really understand how intelligence and security works, aren't blaming the government. They're, you know, rallying around, you know, peace and writing chalk on the, you know, on the pavement in front of Place de la Bourse. They're not really blaming anyone per se. I mean, they're blaming Daesh. They're blaming ISIS. Some of the older people are certainly blaming the government, and they're saying, you know, one person I heard from said, you know, in the chandelier of intelligence agencies in Europe, you know, Belgium is the dimmest bulb, essentially. So, you know, which is a prevalent really opinion around here, that Belgium really is lacking in the cooperation amongst all the agencies, possibly because of the language difficulties, possibly because of bureaucracy.
You've also been speaking to people within the Moroccan community in Belgium who've been out in some force in Place de la Bourse. Has there been sort of much of a community spirit really amongst people in Belgium today, in Place de la Bourse in particular?
Yeah, I mean, that area is really, I mean, it's very reminiscent of what I saw in Place de la République in Paris back in November. Slightly smaller scale, just because the space is just a bit smaller, but the same kind of energy, lots and lots of people there, lots of security there as well. But what you refer to, I mean, yeah, we were just at this very large, I don't know if you could call it a rally, but I mean, elements of the Moroccan community were there with Moroccan and Belgian flags, chanting very loudly, very passionately, and also not in necessarily in an angry way. They were, I'm not going to use the word happy at all, but they were kind of saying, you know, this is not us. This is not, you know, Islam for, you know, I mean, the Moroccan population here is one of the largest populations of immigrants in Belgium. And they're saying, you know, this isn't us. So, and what was remarkable there is, you know, it was very young kids too, and very elderly people as well, all in Place de la Bourse. And it's continuing, you know, all of yesterday, all of today. It doesn't look like it's stopping, really.
Daniel Giacopelli in Brussels, thank you very much indeed. And you can hear more from Danny on the Monocle Daily at 2200 London time. We'll be broadcasting live from both London and Brussels. Zanya Wicket, in a sense, right now is the easy bit. There can be rallies. We can all say je suis whatever. There can be stirring speeches about national unity. But in a week, in 2 weeks, in a month, the underlying problems still remain.
Yes, and this very much, and again, I hark back to 9/11, the Belgians need to use this not just as a rallying cry, but they need to use this as an action-forcing event, if you will. If they want to not ensure this is never going to happen again, because, frankly, whether it's in Belgium or it's elsewhere, it will almost certainly happen again in some form or another. This is the true needle in a haystack. Very, very hard to prevent. But if they want to make it harder for anybody to do this again. There are certain actions that need to be taken, of which intelligence sharing is one, of which working with the police force is another, and collaborating between police forces is another, not just on intelligence, but on other security measures, firming up their airport security, etc. There are things that they will need to do to make it harder for any terrorist attack to be successful, and they need to use this as an action-forcing event to make that happen.
And yet, Cathy Burke, there is, as Zanya says, Belgium as a government, as a nation, needs to start to do things differently. But they also need to be careful about the language they use and about whether they're getting the balance right between security and freedom. So, for example, you had the French Prime Minister Manuel Valls yesterday talking about this being a war. And yet the Belgian Prime Minister Charles Michel was actually a bit more careful about that and try not to use that sort of language. We haven't also seen anything on the par of Tony Blair after the 7th of July attacks in the UK, saying the rules of the game have changed and listing all these things that must change in British society. Getting that balance right is very difficult, isn't it?
I think the term war on terror George Bush using it tainted it, I think, as a slogan forever after. So coming out of the French, I think that was a bit of a shock. Yes, I mean, winged words, as Homer said, once they go out, they can't be called back. And you have to be very careful. There's a lot of wounded pride out there. There's a lot of apprehensive people out there of different nationalities who fear they're going to be stomped on because they happen to be the wrong ethnicity or the wrong religion. But of all the countries in Europe that have to come together as a unified whole, it is very difficult to imagine another one that's going to be as difficult as for Belgium. It was only spatchcocked together back in the 19th century to act as a barrier against an expanding France. The question of whether it has an organizing principle itself is something the Belgians have worried about for a century. So there's no doubt that Daesh picked the single weakest link in Europe, I think, to make this attack.
It's also a very important link. It represents Europe. The European Union, the European Commission sit in Belgium, in Brussels. It has a whole set of other problems. It didn't have a government for quite a while.
500, more than 500 days, yeah.
Exactly. Of all the countries in Europe, it has the highest percentage of the population who's gone to Syria to fight. So it is clearly getting something quite apart from the its ability to provide security for its own residents. It has some real underlying problems that it needs to get a handle on, that it needs to deal with, that it clearly isn't at the moment. And so there are some lessons perhaps that can be learned from others, not necessarily the Americans or the French or the Brits even, but there are some lessons learned that need to be gained.
And there is this issue, Cathy Burke, isn't it? Because it's very easy for some commentators to say, oh, well, look, there is a small minority of Muslims who need to integrate better into this nation. But when you don't have, as you say, sort of a fundamental idea of what your nation is, that becomes far harder to do, doesn't it?
Well, indeed. And that I go back to my earlier comment that's the main problem is that is there a there? You know, what do you actually, I mean, you make the point extremely well, Steve. I mean, what are you actually going to integrate within, into, with whom, without, or whatever? And certainly one problem seems to be that the Belgian state, such as it is, has pretty well ignored a lot of these neighborhoods for years. I mean, Molenbeek keeps coming up, and it hasn't had any attention for the last generation. So all of a sudden, all of these ignored, poor, unemployed, rather scoffed at people are supposed to be Belgians to the core. Well, they aren't terrorists, but doesn't mean they're necessarily going to turn in their brother when he turns out to be on the run. I mean, it's integration is not just of people; it's the whole neighborhoods, the whole area, and that is something the Belgians are going to have to work at. And it's just hard to see how it's going to work.
Okay, we'll leave it there. There was one other major story over the last couple of days, which at any other time would have been deemed historic and would have taken up a whole program. We're going to give it at least 10 minutes after this short break.
Our ideas-packed entrepreneur's guide. The design directory for people who want to build a better home. The style guide for getting to grips with the business of looking good. The soft power survey. The travel top 50. Monocle magazine has a superlative lineup of survey reports and investigations coming your way. And to make sure that you never miss an issue, you just need to do one thing. Become a Monocle subscriber. Not only will you get all of this great journalism, you'll also have free access to our full archive of stories online, receive invites to subscriber events around the world, and be sent a free gift too. Go to monocle.com/subscribe to join us today.
And you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me here in Studio One, Xenia Wickett and Kathleen Burke. By the time Air Force One left Jose Marti International Airport yesterday afternoon, President Barack Obama's historic three-day visit had been deemed a success. In his keynote speech on the last day of that visit, President Obama said it was time for the old Cold War foes to leave the past behind and make a journey as friends, neighbours and as family together towards a brighter future. What warm words, Xenia. But, you know, let's... And we can mock a little. But he's right, isn't it? This is actually quite a big historic deal.
It is. It's going to be very interesting to see how it plays out in terms of Obama's legacy. Because if you look at Obama's foreign policy legacy, there's no question that this outreach to Cuba, this new relationship, the Iran nuclear deal, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the trade deal with Asia, are three of his great achievements. But the Cuba deal is an interesting one, because in 5 years, will we even remember? Because so many people believe, well, this should have been done years ago. This should have been done decades ago. I mean, this is a kind of a legacy of the old world, not the new.
They will see it as, well, it was no big
exactly.
deal.
Exactly, you should have done it anyway.
Why wouldn't anyone not?
Yeah. Exactly. So it'll be interesting to see whether this really in 5 or 10 years is an achievement. But nevertheless, it really should be considered as such, because you have to remember, I mean, I was looking, reading some of the press this morning, the last sitting American president to visit Cuba, which of course is pretty close to the United States.
90 miles.
Yes, people get on boats to come over to the United States, was 88 years ago.
The great Calvin Coolidge.
Exactly. You know, so I mean, this is a real step forward, not just the opening to Cuba, and slowly but surely the relaxing of a whole load of sanctions and other limitations that there have been for 50 plus years, but actually the president visiting, and that clearly has resonated.
And what's interesting, Kathleen Burke, is that, you know, there'd been some criticism beforehand that had the US essentially sort of given up too little in return for Cuba opening up. They've been too focused on trade and not enough on human rights or on democracy. And yet in President Obama's speech, which was broadcast live on TV across Cuba, he talked about the importance of democracy. He talked about the importance of free speech, of dissent, of human rights. That would not have been comfortable for the Castro administration, would it?
No, and it also, various things. First of all, it sums up the fact that there are huge numbers of people that are not going to like anything that Obama does. I agree with you, there was very little that one could do more than he had done. And indeed, remember, Castro got asked questions at a press conference, which is the first
about
time in his life.
About political prisoners.
That's right.
He claimed there weren't any.
And if he found if someone gave him a list, they'd all be
which
gone
they
by
did.
That night.
Yeah.
All 58 of them. Are they still there?
They're still in prison.
They're still in prison.
Yes, what a surprise. I mean, one thing that strikes me about this is that it's a symbol as well. I mean, it's a symbol of America opening itself up or opening its interest with any luck, not wholly predatory interest, to Latin America as a whole, which has been pretty ignored for quite a long time. I mean, Obama is saying that, look, We should work together. And there's no doubt that if people are trading a lot with America, and if they get the internet and so forth and so on, it's bound to liberalize. Castro is an old man. He can't hang around for that long. And what's... It just seems to me that Obama's legacy is going to be rather different than opening oneself to a little island 90 miles south. It's going to open America to the whole southern part of the hemisphere.
I agree with that, but I mean, I think it is... I liked Kathy's use of the word symbol, because Obama getting out there, answering Q&A, he symbolized what it is that so many people love about the United States. I mean, we criticize the U.S. all the time, but... You know, a sitting president being willing to sit there and I think spend 45, 50 minutes answering Q&A from the media, it was a great symbol of what you can be and what you can do and of what many people to aspire to. You know, what many Cubans who would have been watching this on TV, who would not have had an opportunity to meet with Obama because the Cubans prevented him from meeting most people, although he did meet some opposition leaders. But, you know, they weren't out on the streets and they couldn't be out on the streets and meeting him in that respect. But what they will have seen is a leader get out there and be called to answer for their actions. And that is an incredible symbol that I think many Cubans and many others perhaps in Latin America or even more broadly will have watched with some envy, perhaps.
The decision to reopen relations with Cuba as well is, Kathy, perhaps symbolic as well of President Obama's attitude to leftist leaders within Latin America, in that he hasn't sought to confront them as his predecessors have perhaps tried, whether that is the Castros, whether that is, you know, Hugo Chavez or subsequently Nicolas Maduro. He hasn't set out to make them enemies of America that have the same status essentially as America does, and in that way has enabled America to have maybe sort of slightly more realistic, more normal relations with those nations.
Well, it's not the sort of thing he does in the first place. Second place, what would it benefit America, or indeed benefit Obama, had he done so? The United States has quite enough enemies without having to create one down in Latin America.
But that is the way that previous presidents have dealt with Cuba, how George W. Bush dealt with Hugo Chavez was talking these people up as if they were the enemy.
But the problem is they are destroying themselves anyhow. It doesn't need American help. And Obama, I have a great deal of time for Obama. I like having a president who thinks. And it seems pretty clear
Make the most of it while you can.
Oh, dear. Yes. We won't go down that road at this point. It just seems that he knows when to keep hands on, hands off, as much as to put hands on. And it's not the idea that they are in difficulty. They're in difficulty themselves. No one can blame the United States, and that's a good thing.
Just a quick thing, because you mentioned, you know, the leaders we might have in the future. One of the interesting things, yes, the Americans have been distracted by primaries yesterday, et cetera, et cetera. But none of the candidates has really used the Cuba visit let's hit Obama. They really haven't. There's all sorts of other things they hit Obama on, but not the Cuba visit, which actually tells you just how much most people kind of said, you know what, this is a fait accompli. This should have been done a long time ago.
Well, that was the interesting thing after Obama's original speech back at the end of 2014 when he announced all this, was that as soon as you saw it, you thought, no one is actually going to reverse this, are they? No new president is going to come in and say, right, we're blocking Cuba again.
Yes, exactly. And so that's, you know, I mean, we worry terribly about what America's foreign policy is going to be like in the new administration, because the alternatives we have are quite distinctly different from one another. But, you know, there are some things that are just so obvious. And this is why I go back to, I wonder whether this will be part of his legacy, because people will actually look at it and say, well, you know, duh, this should have been done a long time ago. Sorry, that wasn't totally eloquent, but... It is, I think, what people will think.
We can end on something that wasn't terribly eloquent. That's fine. Xenia Wickett and Kathleen Burke, thank you both very much indeed. Thanks also to Danny Jacopelli in Brussels. As I said before, you can hear more from Danny at 2200 hours London time. He'll be live in Brussels on the Monocle Daily. Midori House was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Charlie Young and Mary Giusti. The studio merger was Christopher Grimes. Colossa Ribello is up next. Then it's The Entrepreneurs. Do stay tuned for The Daily as well later, 2200 hours. Midori House back same time tomorrow, 1800 here in London, 1400 at the moment in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.